Leancast, product innovation and UX design with Bonanza Design.
We are live. I'm here with Yaron Otter and Boris Yoke. Folks, we've done a bit of a practice to get these names right.
Sorry.
These two gentlemen are from KUS Service Design Studio. They have, don't get me, please correct me, they have a branch in Amsterdam, they have a branch in Berlin, and they have a branch in
Lisbon.
Lisbon. Yaron is the managing director of the Berlin office. He has tons of experience when it comes to service design. He's the guy to talk to when it comes to experience design and service design. Boris is I love his title, lead data infused designer. Data infused, so catchy. Love it. Mm-hmm. Really cool guys, really cool service design agency. I'm really happy that we bumped into each other. Gentlemen, how are you doing? Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yaron, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having us, Berat. I'm doing great. Like you said, I have a lot of experience in service design.
Works so humble. Post.
No. I mean, like, so I used to be a service designer at KUS in Amsterdam. Then I moved to Berlin in 2019. Worked for other agencies like IXDS, which was bought by PwC at some point. So I worked for PwC. Also did some months in working for PwC Istanbul in Turkey. And then in December, KUS came back to me while I was already working for Berlin. And they said, like, hey, we actually want to open up our third office in Berlin. And we would like to do it with you. So bringing the band back together. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm doing now.
Awesome.
And Boris.
Yeah, hi. My name is Boris. I am very experienced when it comes to service design. I'm also very humble. All things considered, I think service design as a field itself is still not very old. So with now up to like 7 years under my belt, I am usually one of the more experienced people in the room. I think that's an honest thing to say. Joined KUS straight out of uni. Have a background in design engineering. So trained, educated product designer, more or less. And because I wasn't very good at drawing and a bit more interested in the whole strategic part of things, I started working as a service designer at KUS. And you said you liked the title that I basically gave myself, data infused design. I spent a lot of time considering what it is that I'm actually doing, because currently at KUS, I'm trying to basically improve our design process with the use of quantitative data every now and again. So I called it data driven design for a bit, but yeah, of course design is data driven, but then the data can be qualitative or quantitative. But what I try to do is basically infuse our design process with quantitative data and thereby making it better, more robust, etc. So that's why I came up with the data infused thing.
Let's talk about it right there. Like, what kind of challenges or frustration or ambiguity you've seen in the previous approaches, not only at KUS, but like with overall design processes, that you realize that there is a need for more quantitative data-oriented, data-driven design process?
Well, the thing is, I think one of the strengths of designers is that we are kind of okay with ambiguity, and we don't need a whole lot of certainty to make decisions and move forward, right? So when we show like three concepts to 10 people and we get some feedback, we're okay with trusting our gut and say, okay, this is probably the most promising if we tweak it a little bit and then move it forward towards delivery. Designers are okay with that. But as soon as your projects become well, bigger and more strategic, and you talk to people higher up in the organization, usually people with some kind of manager or president behind their title, they are the ones who are saying, yeah, okay, we only spoke to five people. We're going to invest a couple of million dollars in or euros in developing this platform. Like, shouldn't we get some more insights in like larger amounts of larger numbers of people? Like, you got these insights from interviewing 20 people. Maybe we should do a questionnaire. Like, yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense to do that. It simply reduces uncertainty. But I think that the requests for this come from people who are usually non-designers. So that's where I think the tension also is. Like, designers are okay with just relying on qualitative data, and making designers aware of the added value of quantitative measures is one of the challenges that I'm currently having inside of our agency.
Yeah, that's a challenge for sure. I think that's, you're spot on this, because designers often I don't know how to put it in words, but they're happy with qualitative.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like they're disconnected with the quantitative size, larger sample size, which actually, if you are selfish about your success or design, if you care about the success of your project, actually the mm-hmm. larger sample size helps you make higher confidence design decisions.
That's the thing. That's exactly the thing. Quantitative data just helps you make better decisions.
Mm.
That's what it does. And I'm trying to integrate that into the projects that we do as much as we can.
But I would say it's still qualitative first, quantitative second. So first understand why and how, and then understand how much, because it helps you in decision making. But I don't know, like, would you actually start with quant? I don't know. It's just like, what we need is inspirational.
We need is a counter of how many times we're going to say it depends, because it depends, right? I'm currently doing a project around facilitating care for handicapped people, and handicapped people. I don't know if that's just the correct terms in this day and age. It is in Dutch. Anyhow, we're talking about people who have a mild mental disability, but also people who have a visual impairment. Like, the scope of people is very broad. So what we did is we dove into the numbers first to see which were the biggest groups and which of these groups called most often to scope the qualitative research that we're going to do after. So sometimes starting with the numbers that are already available, I mean, that's not even an analysis, right? That's just how many of each are there, and then maybe we should talk to them first. Starting with that does make sense.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
To sort of see the opportunity, and the opportunity is better to be have quantified than qualitative.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you want to reduce the number of calls, maybe first see how many calls you get about each subject to start. Okay, maybe we should tackle that one first then.
It's quite interesting, because it's always also, I said I worked for a bit at PwC, and PwC, of course, is known for auditing, and they also have sort of more traditional, I would say, management consultants working there, and they also have strategic consultants working there. Strategy End is part of their group, I would say, and they would actually always start with quantifying the opportunity and then sort of narrowing it down to, yeah, so what are we going to do with that? And for me, that was actually quite new back then, to sort of see that happening. So them going from like this big chunk to smaller opportunities, but actually it makes sense in that sense to combine those, so quantified opportunities, and then doing research in this group. And then coming up with inspiration for, I don't know, new business models or innovations.
Yeah.
So by quantifying the opportunity means like understanding the size of the demographic, like which region, what's the percentage amongst this type, what's the percentage among this type. So if you see that this problem deal with, so 50%, like this type, this group of people, which contains 50% of our sample size, deal the most with the problem, hence let's focus on them first.
Yeah. Well, you could go that way, or you could, like, the call center example that I had was, like, for one of our clients, they knew that their every time they got an inbound call, on average, it cost them €8.
Oh, wow.
So then if you know we get 100,000 calls about that subject, that would give you, that would be 8 million of costs. If you were to reduce that by 50%,
800,000.
Oh yeah, 800,000. Yeah, like I said. Okay, I'm the quant guy, man. No, okay, 800,000 euros, whatever. If you were to reduce that number of calls, that would give you opportunity costs of 400,000 euros. So if you were then to say, okay, let's spend 50,000 euros to fix that problem, that would give you a profit of X. And then, like, the business case of things also becomes easier if you know the numbers beforehand.
Well, yeah, that's very powerful. I'm really happy that we talk about this, because that's one thing that designers don't often like, it's not even on the radar that, hey, why don't I quantify the outcome of my design?
Mm-hmm.
What it does for your business, what it saves for your business, is going to save you 500,000, well, 300,000 in the first year, 800,000 in the second and third, you're sitting at 1,900,000 save in 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. But I think it's just coming from education. You know, like, we are design engineers, and okay, we did a master's in strategic product design, so we sort of dealt for a bit with this, with business cases, etc. But it's not something people who are coming from design field are super comfortable with. They think it's like a sort of other field, you know, the Excel field, the calculations. But I've worked together with these sort of more quant people, and the thing is, it's still sort of ballpark estimates. But it's, at least it's more, because you can't predict the future. Like, we don't even know what weather is going to be like next week. So it's, but try to make a sort of ballpark guess that already gives the people around you more comfort and more confidence in the decisions you make.
Yeah. And make it explicit, right? If you talk about people, paying their bills, for example, and if you say, hey, if we place this intervention here, then even if 5% more people pay their bills on time, that would save you X amount of euro. Like, doing the, like, we should be able to have that conversation. But for many designers, that's just really hard to do somehow.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, this being uneducated about the how the businesses work, how business models, the components of a business model. Like, you know, I've worked with designers that, you know, they would come up with a system of operation, and they would say, hey, let's set up a call center. But they don't have an understanding. A call would cost $8, right? Can the business scale such an offering?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, sometimes we are a bit out of touch with reality. But I also think this is maybe also a pitfall of the design consultant coming in from an external perspective. We often struggle with just understanding how an organization works, what the business model works like. Like, I work a lot in health insurance, for example. Truly understanding how a health insurance works and how a health insurance organization works, like, that's a day job in itself. So if you want to really determine the impact or the implications of the designs that you propose or the services that you propose, you have to truly also understand the business of the client. And if you're an external consultant, you're not working for one client, you're working for, like, I don't know, 5 or 10 clients in a year. So that implies, if you want to do this properly, that you have to understand each and every one of them. And that's super hard.
Mm. Yeah,
I think it's a fantastic point. But it's hard to understand how, for example, healthcare organization work. But given the position of external designer, I would argue, actually, because of the same very same position, it's you can expect the external designer to come in on risk, because basically that's your job, to come into an organization, try to quickly as quickly as possible to learn and understand how the system works to be able to start your work. So because of this position, I see us as a sort of like we are forced to become system thinkers.
Yeah,
and understand systems at large.
I think that's always good. Like I think as consultants, as design consultants, with the techniques that we have, we are experts at becoming experts. So we don't. Like we don't need to do long projects. Just talk to the experts that are at the company and try and get as much value from these conversations that they have. And also don't try to get too deep into it, because then you become them. And there's a reason why you're hired as an external, because you need fresh perspectives as well. So there's this sort of fine line of like how much you need to know and how much would be like an overkill and sort of squeeze all inspiration and all innovation out of your approach as well. So I think it's good, of course, to make a stakeholder map, to make a bit of a systems map, but yeah, there's also a limit to that.
I do feel a tension here, right? Because often we are hired to tell clients things that they don't know, but then if we spend time figuring out things that they already know but that we don't know, then there is little direct value for the client in us doing that. Like if you make a proposal for a new project and you put in like desk research, and the client's like, what are you going to do? And I say, yeah, we're going to figure out how your business works. And I'm like, yeah, we know how our business works. Like why mm-hmm. should we pay you to figure that out?
Do they? Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes it's even that complex that they don't even know. Like you're only one part, one number in the whole system. I think it's an assumption to say that they actually know how their company really functions.
It depends.
That's where service design tools are valuable for.
It depends. But the thing is, especially in within the scope of a project where you often only have, that's also a problem. Like the scope of a project where you have like 4 weeks, 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the beginning, how much time are you going to spend on figuring out what their user wants and how their organization works? Because you need to understand both to be able to come up with proper new like propositions, design services, whatever. But we spend most time on figuring out what their user wants, because that's also new and valuable to the client. Mm-hmm. And figuring out how the organization works, which would leverage the way that we can present our design proposals and like make the business case, and because we truly mm-hmm. understand how that often lacks, because we just don't have the time, or we didn't allocate the time for that within the scope of the project.
On the other hand, isn't this also one of the values of service design being mm-hmm. Co-creative, and also means that you develop solutions that are actually developed together with people at the company, so to sort of try and prevent the first pitfalls to happen.
Okay, but then let me put out a statement. Like yeah. What we often say is we are very good at service design, so we know the process and we know the design process, and we will get the insights from your users. You are very good at understanding your organization.
Company.
Yeah, so the responsibilities is that we will make sure that we will come up with things that are desirable, and then you will figure out whether things are viable and feasible. Mm-hmm. And that's really easy for us as designers, because then we don't have to think about that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that works?
I think so. But often you realize that the solution that we are designing... So this, you guys seem like... We are more on the service design path. I'm more on the digital application path. So
mm-hmm.
we design a lot of not only digital application. We design a lot of insurance policies, for example, too. But you know in terms of the digital application, you know, desirability of solution is only one part of a great design. Viability mm-hmm. of it also is important, and often the Achilles heels of startups and companies is that they really cannot scale their designs.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do then?
It's we help them with in terms of digital application, so we do research, discovery, prototyping, testing, and designing the application, but also we offer a service which is exclusive service. It's called UX engineering, right? Mm-hmm. It's basically engineering the solution, supporting the dev team to really be able to launch this application. Because what often happens is like we design an application, we put it in front of the customer, mm-hmm. and then they give us a green light, and then 6 months later, they still haven't coded it, and they haven't even started. They haven't got around it. So, scaling and coming up with a viable solution is also something that a lot of companies lack, to be honest.
It's interesting. We are actually now also. So it might not look like we are only a service design company, but actually we're not. I think actually our strength is the combination of service design and UX/UI design. So a lot of our projects are also a combination of these two, where the service designer is more in the lead of the research in the beginning, and the strategy, defining the strategy for, and it could also be a digital product. And then the UX designer is already involved in the beginning, so they know the sort of, the insights and the opportunities, and they are more responsible for the actual, the classical designing the right thing versus mm-hmm. designing the thing right. So it's really great to have those both in your team when you create solutions. So I think that what we've discussed before, the projects were more like very much service design focused, but we also work in, let's say, service design, UX design projects. For instance, we did recently a project for a company called Eurocross. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you fall off your scooter in Bali and you have to go to the hospital, you call them, and they are basically the organization that helps you through this sort of jungle of bureaucracy in hospitals and in insurance, etc. And they were actually doing very well, but they were also just a phone number, so they had a lot of costs. Like we said, this $8, €5 per call, that actually adds up if you keep on calling. So mm-hmm. they thought, hey, there's actually opportunity for digitalization. Mm-hmm. And they had really good reviews. So people were actually very happy. So we wanted to sort of combine this, keeping people happy, but also doing it in a more efficient way. And then you sort of, what you do is you try to understand what's actually the current process. So like mm-hmm. it's very much service design focused. So like what's actually happening? So we actually talk to people that actually use this service in the last 6 months. And so we got a lot of pictures of people with broken legs, et cetera. And so you map that in a classical customer journey. And there, for instance, we found out that actually this first call that you have, when you fell off your scooter and you're completely burned, then having someone on the line who actually speaks your language and that can actually sort of comfort you, that's super valuable. That you shouldn't digitize that. So solution, we decided we're not going to digitize that. But then there were also other contact moments with Eurocross where it was just about getting an update, like how's my case doing, etc., or uploading some bills, etc. Yeah, those you can of course very well digitize. So that's what we did, and that's a great combination of having service designers understanding the whole problem, having UX designers understanding how to sort of come up with a MVP of something that's valuable and feasible and doable.
And being at the organization long enough to understand how they work, right? Because we also spend time in their call center to really understand what are the subjects of the calls, what are the implications for people on the ground and the people in the call center of the subjects that they discuss. Also talking to the people in the contact center, like, okay, which types of calls do you get? And what are the things where you think you add value as a person of contact, as a human being in that service?
Yeah.
And it's I think it's also a great example of also the combination of qual and quant. So qualitative research, like understanding this journey, and quantified understanding what are the topics of the calls in the call center. Which helped us in the decision making of deciding on what's going to be the first MVP of this digital tool and what's going to be the second MVP. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like that, it's the results are like, I'm sounding too salesy, but the results are really good. Like really time saving per case are awesome. Like a minimum of 25% and up to, even more in the second MVP. So, and if you quantify that again to like thousands of calls to these people on the phone, that's really gonna save money. So, and that's, I think, is the value of service design with UX design.
First of all, thanks a lot for sharing this case study. I know that NDAs are a bit problematic when it comes to sharing this kind of stories, but that's a very beautiful example of human-centered design empowered by research, meet the business needs, and create a common ground that creates a designs that help service provider feel fulfilled by doing their jobs. Hey, I really don't want to talk about the bills with the customers, but I really want to help them with their, you know, with their struggle, you know, as a call center person, a person who works in the call center, I feel a sense of meaning by doing my job. And also it helps the customers who's going through something, talking to someone. But at the end of the day, the solution that you design also is saving the business considerable amount of money by automating all the other things that no one benefits from doing it manually.
Mm-hmm. And you don't want to know, these companies, all these sort of assistant companies, they are in big problem trouble right now because they have a huge lack of staff and they digitize too late. So this Eurocross case is actually also a great example of like, there you see it all around you, you know, the great resignation, the shortage of people, of how you can sort of keep up a sort of level of service with fewer people as well needed, and better do it now than actually when you're in the real trouble that some of these companies are.
I actually wanted to ask you a question. What's the difference between service design and UX design? And you sort of like beautifully gave a 101 on service design by offering an example. So it's thanks a lot for doing so.
Maybe to weigh in on that, like I had a discussion with our lead UX designer, actually, like what's the difference between UX design and UX design? Yeah. Because our UX designers are so involved with like the
serve design,
with the serve design aspect of things. So with why are we making what we are making in creating this digital product, which needs are we addressing? What are the drivers and motivations of people using this product, and how are we going to translate that into designs? And I think that's what our UX designers do. And I think if you compare that to how some of our, well, maybe not some of our clients necessarily, but how some other organizations see UX designers, just, okay, these are just the people that execute the design requirements and they're just mindlessly building screens. There's a huge difference between UX design and UX design. That's what I wanted to point out.
100%. I think at the end of the day, it's a war of titles. Like each role wants to get a bit more credibility or credit for the entire design process. And I think at the end of the day, every designer, regardless of whether you're a service designer, UX designer, or product designers, you need to be able to have this, to be able to do research, to understand the system, to understand whoever that is involved in the system and get affected by it, for good and bad. This should be like a baseline skill set for every designer.
Yeah, yes. True. It's also about perception, I think. Like if you say you are a UX designer, how is that perceived? The person on the other end, what do they expect you to be able to do?
Yeah, and I think that's what we're running into now, that that is sometimes a challenge, because if we say I'm a UX designer, people expect you to be a mindless screen producer, basically.
Right, they can just drop their ideas and you just execute them.
Yeah.
Actually, there was when I was studying, that was one of the reasons why, for instance, I didn't want to become a product designer, because I didn't want to be this sort of like, you just give me an assignment and I'll do it. Yeah. Create the next vacuum cleaner. Okay, I'll do it. Ta-da, here's a design. Like, I wanted to strategically think together with the client, like, what should we actually make another vacuum cleaner? Maybe there would be something else. And so it's also a bit like how you want to fulfill your role. Like, do you want to think more strategically, or are you more okay with just executing tasks? I mean,
and a lot of, like, I can't tell you, because, like, I'm so deep in the startup world, right? And a lot of startups would benefit from your services, because they are doing this mindless screen pushing, pixel pushing, without doing enough strategic work. And the strategic work is sort of like crowdsourced amongst product managers, tech leads, and business developers. None of them are getting paid to do strategy work.
Mm-hmm.
And no one acknowledged the work of strategy in the organization. They think that, oh no, we always think strategically. No problem. We can do a strategy. Why do we need a strategist designer in the house? Because no one is getting paid for it to do this full time. Like, not like 8 hours in that manner, but like, you need to be obsessed with this overall strategy of the business, the business vision, the product strategy, and the experience strategy. What do you want to, like, deliver?
But doesn't that also have to do with the perception of what it is that a strategic designer does? Because I, like, Jeroen and me, we both have the academic title of strategic designer. And usually, if it goes wrong, we just spend a whole shitload of time doing research and doing analysis and then coming up with plans. And then if you're a startup, you basically ran out of time and you still have nothing actionable. So
yeah,
from a startup perspective, I understand that they don't have the, how do you call that? The patience to work with a horizon that is a bit longer than they are comfortable with.
Yeah. But I like this saying a lot. Never enough time to do it right, always enough time to do it over. You know, like, this sort of excuse of "hey, nobody got time for that" is very easy to do. You know, like, let's just go. You know, let's just go somewhere. I don't like that.
But what I was getting at is, like, the other side of that coin is that you take forever to prepare the best strategy. Sure. And then you still have nothing. So you should find a middle ground and be a bit pragmatic. And I think a pitfall of people in our position is that we are not pragmatic.
Yes. I think it's a different landscape. I think in the landscape of big organizations, you want to apply delay. You want to be cautious, because if you want to go too fast, maybe you overlook certain variables that are really important in the overall strategy or overall, like, service design designing the service design blueprint or entire customer journey experience, right? In the startup landscape, it is encouraged to go fast. So instead of, like, taking a lot of time to do strategy, you want to just do strategy in very iterative batches, right? And that's how you can, like, sort of, like, go around doing, like, go around up proposing a contained package for strategy and discovery and research to startups that are, like, really worried about time and, you know, running out of funding and stuff.
Exactly. No, I agree.
Yeah. It's quite interesting, because it reminds me a bit of a talk that one of my colleagues, our UX lead, Emily, gave recently about our work for. So we designed the Dutch COVID passport app in the Netherlands, which was of course a crazy project. Yeah, I mean, of course it's cool that an agency which is not one of the big ones was allowed to do it, but it was it was she. we sort of talked about this whole experience of doing it, and we sort of came to the conclusion that it was actually a bit of a startup experience, mm-hmm. because there was huge time pressure to get something up. Like, we need to get a MVP within 7 weeks. There was no time for research, actually, or at least there was like parallel lines of development and actual research. Oh, you're there back. So it was really not the ideal, the ideal process, but you still sort of have to deal with it. And I think it sort of taught us a lot also of like how to cope with this sort of startup-y mindset of like, just get something done and learn from your output. Like, what we, for instance, learned is that basically, if you don't have time for research upfront, use your gut feeling as a designer, like that we could do because we have a lot of experience with other projects. Use that to make decisions and make them as good as you can. But then make sure that your connection with your support, so with the people that are in contact with the users and the backend, is super good. So you can learn from that. So okay, then maybe not have research upfront, but at least have validation in the back, and very well validation.
How did you get the project? There are a lot of big agents. Yeah,
so actually it's not even that it's not even that much of a spooky or like a, there's not really a secret to it. Well, basically the first focus of like the main app was back then was the remember the Bluetooth app, you know, like you've been in da-da-da. That was the app that everybody was talking about. Like, this is going to solve, I don't know, this is going to be super important for COVID. And then came sort of this idea from the Dutch government, like, we actually want to open up society. We want to open up, the cultural sector and the gastronomy. Maybe let's do it with this QR code. It was not even a big thing back then. And they hired a team of developers, if I'm correct. And these developers, they knew us from other work that we did together with them. They sort of got us in as a sort of subcontractor for that. So it was led by developers, like, which is sort of maybe how the world works. Like, developers have the lead and then designers come in through the back door. That's how we came in as well.
It's interesting that you didn't make the mistake. Like, we did make the mistake in Germany, and we did make that Bluetooth thingy. So I remember I downloaded the Bluetooth application, and I went to the bouldering, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I put my phone in the locker, and I did bouldering, came back, and as soon as I opened my phone, it says like, "Warning! You just in exposure of someone that had COVID." It was like, Jesus. And then at that point, I realized I need to delete this till they remove this feature because it's very stressful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw an article in the Netherlands where they calculated the number of COVID cases that were discovered through the app against the total costs of developing the app. That was harsh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think it's also good to mention that we are not tech optimists, you know, like, I think we are tech realists, and even though we create digital products, we are the first to say that they don't work. We are the first to say to clients, you don't need an app, you know, like, it's sort of like, when we make something, it's also our time that goes into designing this, you know, like, we don't just want to make money and then have like another app for the app graveyard. We want to have something that actually is being used. So in that sense, I would say Coase is not, we're not into the funky apps, you know, like flashy things for your campaign. We want to see it like, okay, we did this whole research. We are not in love with apps. Could also be something else. Okay. In the end, the app is the best solution. Well, let's create an app. But for instance, also like a great example of like the Corona app. Mm-hmm. That's not just an app. It was an app. It was a website. It was a paper form. It was a storytelling video, etc. Because we realized if you're just going to focus on only an app, you're not going to be able to serve the whole country. Like, we needed to have something that was actually usable for the entire country.
You're making a really good case for a service design agency to be at the center of design process. Because if you leave a big design project that has a really serious socio-technological effects on our lives to a solely dev agency or to a solely app design agency, it's called app design agency. We are going
They're just
going to
say yes, yes, sure,
yes, let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it because I'm an app design agency, duh. So I will build you a glorious looking, amazing, awe-inspiring, smell nice app.
I want a nice smelling app. Who doesn't want a nice smelling app?
There you go. That's my point. No, I think it's very necessary to have, especially for like big for projects that concern the entire society, to have people coming in and question whether we need applications, another application in our like app list.
It's actually also one of the reasons why, for instance, we don't have internal developers, but we work together with partners. Because if you have developers, they need to have work. So you're going to look for things that they can work on. And we want to have this freedom to sort of decide if we need, I don't know, iOS or Android or some native or some web apps, etc. Like we want this freedom. Otherwise, it's not in the spirit of design. You know, like we want to be in love with the problem, not with our solution.
100%. I think it's very important, especially for today's society, that we really cannot afford to have another application. I think we have reached a point of oversaturation of applications, and that I don't know. I mean, it's my experience. My experience is not comprehensive enough, but like at the end of the day, everyone in their app, you know, in their phone, they are, it all comes down to few selected applications everyone uses.
Yeah. That's exactly. Like, I feel for these people that have made these apps, you know, like you put your whole heart into this and then, it's just, turns out not to be useful or not to be successful or something like this. Like, I would get a burnout from this if I would work on those kind of projects, and I don't want a burnout. But I think regarding this service design being part of the process, there was also in this talk of Emily, she also showed like the whole sort of the sprint rhythm that they had, and I think only our service designer was the only one that was actually involved in every step. And that could actually, you know, that could sort of capture this red line of the red thread of are we still doing the right things? Mm-hmm. And also, for instance, when new feature requests or something, new requirements came in, to be the voice of the user, you know? And that's a super important role to have, even though maybe the process is not optimal, to always sort of fight for this user in the end and not for your own need of, no, like there was legal there was development there were you know other politicians there to sort of say like, okay, we want this, but it's not gonna work, you know, like this is, and that's in the end goal, to make something that's usable, that's inclusive as well.
Yeah,
like we did tests with blind people using the app. We did, you know, like tests with a lot of minority groups that were that should be should be on the app or should be on, let's say, the system. I wouldn't even like the fact that I call it an app is just for ease, but it's actually not, like I said, not an app. It's a website, etc. Yeah. But that was, for instance, the reason. Like, if it wouldn't have been up to the designers, it would have been only an app.
Mm-hmm. 100%. So, question for both of you. Really interested and curious to know. So, you know, for example, let's bring the same example that you mentioned, the call center, right? Or any similar example. These projects are, so you're dealing with a large organization. There are a lot of moving pieces. they understand, are spending a lot. So they have a sense of awareness of what the problem is and what the desired state or ideal scenario could look like, right? But mm-hmm. they don't know how to go about this. They call Kos, Boris or Jeroen. What should we do about this? How do you go about, I ask this question because I know that you need time to basically onboard into the projects.
Mm-hmm.
It may take 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, depending on how large, if it's, for example, if it's Coca-Cola or if it's a region in India that you want to work with the municipality of a region in India, good luck. A city in India is like 20 million. Mm-hmm. So how do you go about managing expectation of your clients in the first days?
Well, I think before you even start a project, you need to write a proposal of what your plans are, like what you want to do. And if you want your proposal to basically be accepted, to get a go on your project, you really want to understand the needs of the person on the other side. So, and usually like the bigger the project, the longer this process takes it's basically a research in and by itself, understanding the person on the other side, understanding their personal drivers and behaviors. So what keeps them up at night? Like, okay, you're asking Kos to help you with that challenge. Okay, sure. But what happens if you don't do anything about that? Like, why is this a problem for you? What happens if you don't address it? How would you dream of it being addressed? And why is that? And trying to peel off the layers of the question that is being asked, getting to the core of the problem on face value, because at that point you don't even have a project yet. So you have to make do with the person in front of you and who they might refer you to. Mm-hmm. And then adapting the proposal to their needs, then getting a go. And then you're only like at the start of the process that you described, right? Yeah. So there's always, you need to get a basic understanding of the challenge before you were even in the project.
Yeah. I think it's also one of the reasons why, for instance, we are sometimes struggling with replying to tenders. You know, tenders are like a sort of, there's not like a blind wall that you have to talk to, or that you get like a sort of assignment and then you have to come up with a solution.
But shooting in the dark.
It's not the fit for the design process. But I'm 100% sure that the design process would come up with way better results than sort of like what's fit for a tender process. Because basically a tender process is you just have to show that you like on the letter that you do what they want. But there's a reason why they hire you and they can't solve it themselves. So they should actually be open for different approaches, for getting our expertise in, for having a discovery part in the beginning, et cetera, et cetera. But the deliverables are already stated in the tender, which is not in our philosophy.
No. And maybe to get back to your question, like, okay, if you have a goal on the project, what do you do in the first week or whatever? Like the double diamond design process, like it, all models are wrong. Some are useful. The double diamond design process is definitely wrong, but definitely sometimes useful. The thing is, you cannot just start, or depending on how you explain it. Like if you start to diverge, right? So to explore the context of the problem that you're trying to figure out, you do that by doing user research, of course, but you also do that by doing like internal research at the client, doing some desk research, doing some interviews, etc. And depending on the scope and the size of the project, that gets bigger or smaller, and the complexity of the project as well. So now I'm currently working on, like I said, a project for people with minor mental disabilities and healthcare that they need to organize around their living situation. That is super complicated. A lot of rules and regulations, a lot of parties involved in doing that. So there's a bigger amount of time in the project allocated to like the internal research and the desk research and the internal interviews and understanding like the stakeholders and everything. And if it's a bit more straightforward, we just do a quick one-on-one with everyone and just dive into the user research.
Yeah, I remember that when we wanted to sort of like understand the philosophy of Bonanza Design and who we are. And then we had this like opportunity to apply to a few tenders, and we did apply to a few tenders. And at that point, I realized that's me not a tender based design studio. I prefer to stay poor than apply to.
Can I tell you one thing?
Yes.
Can I tell you one thing?
Please
this
do.
Is the power. This is the power of the companies like PwC, Deloitte Digital, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. They have whole departments who are specialized in replying to tenders. Exactly this game. It's just like with ad agencies. They have people that are specialized in replying to award shows. It's a different game. It's a job.
Yeah, the thing is, like at Coase, we are doing it more and more now, applying to tenders, because we now have also some of the relations that we had due to the COVID project. So we also get invited to participate in tenders more and more. And I always feel like if you're invited, then your chances from the start are a bit better. But I always, like when I work on a tender, I cry a little on the inside because I know, because I know that there's someone at Deloitte who has been doing this for 20 years and exactly knows the words to use and the hoops to jump through and like and push the buttons that they want to hear. Like
another problem, it doesn't matter if you are doing a good job. So like as long as you apply for the tender and you get the job, nobody looks at the result anymore because the next assignment is going to be a tender again. So they're going to, like you build up a sort of credibility from doing it.
Yeah, and I'm going to say this up front, we might have to take this out, but more and more our strategy is becoming just say exactly what we want and what they want. And then if we won, we will just do what we want to do.
Exactly.
We probably need to take this out.
It's so horrible.
You deliver two tenders, and like because we are the same people working on the tenders, so I think they are probably of more or less equal quality. And then for one tender, you score 30 out of 100 points, and then for another tender, you score 95 out of 100 points.
Exactly.
And we are doing the same thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Fuck tenders.
But the problem is like. If there's any organization that needs service design, it's government. So that's why it's a very important problem, this, what we're discussing right now. It's actually where the biggest opportunity is, where the biggest purpose is, where the biggest impact is, but also where the biggest barriers for entry are.
Can we service design the tender process?
Exactly. I wanted to come in and say we really need to get rid of these tenders because it undermines meritocracy.
Mm-hmm. No. I disagree. Tenders are very important because they counter corruption.
In the end, it's
public money. I think they're super important to have because it sort of makes the play field equal. Not like, mm-hmm. I know this person working at the ministry, so I can do this. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have that. That's in other countries where they do that. We don't do that.
I agree.
So it's
important
that it's there, but it's just a big pain and it can be done differently. Like the way it's done now doesn't need to be the final way. It can always be done differently and mostly better.
I'm putting you on the spot, but would you have ideas of how it could be done differently? Because, my problem with tenders here is that you mentioned, right? Small players that are very capable and probably could have very unique ideas to solve that problem, elevate the situation, and improve everyone's lives do not get a chance because your brand equity cost versus PwC or I don't want to drop names because, I respect everyone in the
Yeah, me too. I respect everyone. One love.
but you know, the big ones, the sharks, not the sharks, but the whales, they are bigger. They have a higher brand equity, and then as a basically person who works at the government or what have you, you do not want to make yourself look bad by going for a sort of like a less known studio, and you want to go with the safe option.
I don't think that's a problem though, because I isn't it with tenders that it's blind, you know, so it's no. It's not blind?
I don't think
so. No, not always. Not always.
No. It sometimes is. Sometimes it's
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... The thing is, sometimes it's still really good to make and to network with government people, because actually what they often say is like, if you're dependent on the tender, you're already lost. Like you need to have some connections with the people that are writing these tenders. That's actually how it in the end still works. It's a bit like, you know, like applying for a job. If you're only like going for jobs and not knowing anyone at the company, you're still 2-0 behind with someone else who actually knows people there. So that's actually
a great design career tip.
Yeah.
100%.
But yeah, so it's, I mean, in the end, for instance, now I'm building up a business here in Berlin and in Germany. I'm not focusing on government, even though I really want to work for government. But it's just that this is not an opportunity for us.
Like, we're not there yet.
They have like things like, I don't know, innovation labs where they're open to startups, etc. For some reason, with startups, they're super cool. But agencies, etc., they're like a closed wall, a door, which is not really opening. Mm-hmm.
Just as inviting as the services they are providing.
I mean, there is some hope, right? I don't know if you saw that there's this department now working within the German government, for instance, on service design topics. I think it's called like Design for Germany or something, or Services for Germany, etc. And they are actually doing good work, but the workload that they have, you know, this sort of mountain of work that they have, it's so much bigger than what they can solve. I would get very demotivated if I would work there. So
yeah,
it's a bit like, I don't know, like the, maybe compare it to like, you should be open to creativity at some point if you actually want to make a movement going on. If you should not only be dependent on this one sort of like Gallic town of service design within a very bureaucratic world. It should be opening up innovation harbors, gates, etc.
Yeah.
And to get back to your question on how to improve the tender process, like I said, it should, like right now, you get a request, you can maybe ask a question and then you get an answer, and that answer hardly ever does anything. Usually it just refers to another part of the tender that you didn't understand in the first place. Anyhow, there is no dialogue. And I think if you want to understand how you can best at least describe the way you add value to the situation of the people needing your services, you need to have at least some kind of dialogue and some kind of interaction and allow for exploration of the issue at hand, and not have the process and the deliverables predefined and then just ask us for the agenda of the different workshops, because we don't know yet, because we don't know what we don't know.
So actually, you're right. I think it should mimic more the natural process of creating a valuable proposal. I'm happy to make it transparent, you know, like I'm happy to remove any doubts about transparency, about, you know, like corruption, etc. Like I'm happy to sit with all the other agencies that are invited or in one room and talk to this sort of client or a government client and discuss it like that, you know, like that's through talking, you get inspired of directions. So I think it should mimic more.
I have to say, sometimes we get invited for something called a market consultation. So then the party from the government, whoever, like ministry or whatever, they invite agencies to just discuss their challenge and present approaches like, oh, if this is your challenge, this is how we would do it. Just for them to refine their idea of the questions that they're asking as input for a tender. So
yeah,
maybe not good. Perfect, but at least it's some kind of a dialogue. And then sometimes after a consultation like that, you get invited to write the tender. Yeah. So that's already better, I think.
I agree. I think so. Even like, you know, it shouldn't be complicated if there are like sensitivities and fairness involved, which I think is a very, very solid case for having the tenders the way it is. You could make it so, for example, you could have like, you know, calls, at least one or two calls with whoever that spent a week writing that tender. Mm-hmm. And you could, the government representative could be coming into the call and do not show their faces. They just like, you can, and you show your faces. I think this is fair because, you know, they're probably going to see, okay, who are we going to work with in future? And you can have a conversation, like, you know, so, mm-hmm. At least, you know, you can ask questions. There's a back and forth, and they can actually see whether you are knowledgeable enough to tackle this challenge and move their situations to a better place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think we all agree on that.
I want to get back to what Jeroen said. I think that's really interesting. And gentlemen, whenever you feel like, okay, you're getting tired, let me know, because it's a joy for me. I'm having a good time.
Jeroen and me can talk for hours.
we're gonna go for another 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and
yeah.
Then we can do part two.
Sure,
yeah. I love that. Yeah. Well, so I think back to Jeroen, because you want to scale your German branch. I think you said something really nice that, you know, all right now, you know, it's service design and how German government, like, you know, allocates priorities to projects is, I don't know anything about this. But if assuming that there's a central place or central organ or certain body of governance that decides on which project gets the priority, as you said, mentioned in your conversation, it's a missed opportunity. But because who gets to decide on which project that we are going to work on, and the ever increasing number of problems that we are facing. Germany is 80 something million population. A lot of immigrants are coming, a lot of new folks are coming in, culture is changing and evolving. Who gets to decide? And one of the things I can have an opinion about is like, socio-political environment of Germany is very reactive to what is hot, what is on, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not, there is not enough foresight in my view when it comes to being strategic about what we're going to achieve in the next year or two or three or four, right? So I think the idea of open innovation sounds very appealing to me.
Can you give me an example of like these social political things happening for me to grasp it a bit better?
Let me see if I have a good example. I want to be cautious about it.
But okay.
This is my, like, this, take this as a, so I've been.
As a given.
I've been reading for the past 2 years every week, Zeit newspaper. So, and the politics section, right? There are examples that I could say, but I want to be cautious about it because not long time ago, I decided to not comment on topics that I haven't done enough studying the topic, right?
That's great.
I think so. I think people need to feel accountable for what they are saying, right? Certain things, like, especially like for complex issues, I told myself, I gave myself a process. Unless I read a book, at least one book about the topic, I'm going to stay silent.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything anymore. This
yeah, I'm sorry. I don't read books.
I don't hear Boris. He's muted.
No, I get your point.
Yeah. That's great. That's actually why I like, for instance, I'm very active on LinkedIn, but I like this sort of people that are, let's say, not all of them are experts, but at least it's sort of like stay in bit in your street of what you know, instead of like already when I see comments of people, I don't know, commenting to politicians saying like, hey, why didn't you fix my road, blah, 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 on LinkedIn, I'm like, I shut down. Like, you know, this is not where I'm in for. No, I like this sort of opinion of like, educate yourself before you talk. That's good. I think it's good.
And often,
do you mean like do your own research, Hilden?
Yeah.
I think it's everyone's responsible. I think it's not justifiable to say, I'm busy, I do not want to read, or I don't want to learn about this thing. Because, like, you know, it's often easy to criticize politicians, but what if you want to live or you want to work as a politician and do their job for a day? You know, like, mm-hmm. we are the service designers, mm-hmm. like in the service design, in the system of product and service, there are many actors involved. Everyone has their own agenda. Everyone has their own, like, hey, I want my road to be fixed, or
mm-hmm. yeah, yeah.
Like, everyone has their, like, you know, we are selfish. There yeah. is. Like, this is the default of humanity. And then the whole job is to sort of like de-selfish ourselves and like give back to the community, right?
Well, I actually just read a book about this, which states otherwise. It's called Humankind.
And?
Well, it's basically that the natural, let's say that the majority of people are not selfish, that actually in mm. times of terror and of crisis, people actually do connect. And it's kind of it's kind of a vision that we tend to tell each other, but I wouldn't say it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what the book says. That there are more examples of people actually sticking up for each other and mm-hmm. being altruistic than there's people actually doing only caring for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Read the book, Rutger Bregman, Humankind. Boris didn't read it.
No, I throw up in my mouth a little bit every time I hear that guy talk.
Hey!
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
I do agree with that point in that book.
Yeah,
but it's the whole book. The whole book is that point.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Like 99% of books should have been a blog post and 99% of blog posts should have been a tweet.
I agree with that. 100%.
And 99% of meetings should have been an email.
Yes.
I agree with that too. 100%.
I mean, the point of the book is explained by the title and I agree. Done.
Yeah, true.
I agree
true.
With that too. Yeah, I mean, a lot of...
I'm sorry.
I think you can boil down all the self-help books, at least I read.
To blog posts, at least.
Or a 60-minute podcast, maybe at most.
Yeah. Do you guys follow... I don't even know if I pronounce his name correctly, but yeah. Ever since I follow Shreyas Doshi, I believe his name is, on Twitter, he is like a product guy and he just drops truth bombs on Twitter. And ever since I followed that, I'm like, I'm not reading books anymore. If the high density quality content on Twitter is already this high, like, why bother reading a paragraph?
Yeah. Or you should,
yeah, he is really good.
Okay, maybe we should put that in the show notes.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, we're definitely going to put that. I'm actually following right now because I get a lot of like this Humankind today. That was the introduction. I'm going to create a post actually of all the books that were suggested at Linkcast and Shreyas Doshi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, this has been a pleasure. Yes. I think we should do more of this triangle more.
Cool.
Yeah.
I like it too. I like this. Yeah.
Me too. Let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
cool.
Yeah. Any last word? I think I want to call this part one. I think it's been a good introduction. Folks, this is the first time I'm meeting Jeroen and Boris. So, Boris didn't know I existed actually.
I saw you in my calendar.
Yeah. So, really, really appreciate for you gentlemen to come on. It's been a pleasure. Yeah. I think we had really such amazing, lovely conversation. Any last word?
Yeah.
A lot of like sort of like up and coming designers listening to this. If you have, I don't want to like put you on the guru
pedestal and like ask you to drop drop an advice or, but like, you know, you have a skin in the game. You're moving, you're dealing with some challenging project. If you would like to sort of like wrap your head around, and if you wanted to, for example, offer your two cents to sort of like up and coming designers in terms of, hey, what they should be paying attention to in 2023, what would be?
Now, what I always say that to people that want to move into service design, of course, read books, service design thinking, service design doing, but also just do it. You know, like it's very easy to start practicing service design practices. Like, you don't have to wait for your first job to start doing it. You can go to your next door bakery and try to improve their services, or you can do it on a very micro scale and learn a lot from that. Talk to five people that are customer there, understand what their pluses and minuses are from being there, and try to move that into an improvement. Like, I like those kind of not like proactive ways of learning instead of waiting for other people to give you stuff to learn from. So that would be my advice, I would say.
Okay.
Go out there.
Okay. Again, who am I saying this to? Up and coming designers. Ooh. Keep up the good work. I think the thing I hate about designers and the design community is that we always talk about design and how important design is, and that design is going to save the world, and that customer journeys are the best thing ever. And like, get off your high horse. The world doesn't revolve around designers. Design isn't going to save the world. It can make a very valuable contribution. Mm-hmm. But they're like, open your eyes, look around, be humble, get inspired by things that others are doing, because we are just relying on the skills of other people to actually make stuff happen. And that goes for, like, I don't know, sustainability experts who can help us in the energy transition. Like, of course, design can play a big role in that. We're never going to be responsible for making that change. So yeah. I think if you're an up and coming designer, don't just focus on the design process and being the best designer that you can be. And like, but look around you and be humble and be inspired by what other people can do. And I think that's when we can make most impact as designers.
Yeah. Love that. That's such a practical skin in the game type advice. I really cannot add so much to this. I think it's a beautiful place to end it. Thanks, boys. Thanks, gentlemen, to be here. And
thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, really liked it.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
See ya.